Welcome to the Successful Farming Podcast. I'm David Ekstrom. Before we get into the podcast, we'd like to thank our sponsor, Case IH. Case IH has solutions for every challenge, equipment for every farm. Case IH is built by farmers.
My mom's got a new Case IH tractor, and it can do it all. Bale hay all day. See in the dark with its powerful LED lights. Hook up all the implements. Shift like a race car. Steer with ease. And it can also cool my juice box. Yeah, her Case IH tractor can do everything she needs it to.
Looking for a tractor that can do it all? Check out caseih.com.
Fifth-generation farmer Jamie Walter was looking to diversify his northern Illinois farm. One night, he was sitting at his desk, sipping on a bourbon, and a light bulb went off. After carefully assessing the farm's strengths and weaknesses, Walter knew growing the grain wasn't going to be the problem. Co-founder, president, and CEO Jamie Walter and Nick Negley, co-founder, vice president, and COO of Whiskey Acres, sat down with successful farming editor Karen Jones to tell their story.
My dad's been farming here for over 50 years now, and I joined him in about 2000, and we were looking for ways to diversify our farming operation and add value to some of the grain that we were growing here. That's the shortened version of things. And so in about 2010 or so, 2009, 10, we started exploring ways to add value to that grain, become vertically integrated. And we were looking at bakery goods, ingredients for the Chicagoland market. You know, everything that we grew here was basically being used for fuel ethanol or exported. And it seemed a lost opportunity as Chicago is continuing to grow our direction to not take advantage of the rising consumer market that was there in Chicago. So we were looking for ways to do that. I had actually started to settle in on the concept of popcorn. We thought we might be the first farm to table competitor of Garrett's popcorn. And so that was kind of the idea. And I was sitting at my desk one evening, looking through spreadsheets on popcorn varieties, and I was sipping on a bourbon. And that's when it kind of dawned on me that, maybe there was a better opportunity in the craft distilling market. That was kind of a newer growth industry and across the country, really in Illinois in particular. And I had a little bit of background in the wine industry. So the concept of making alcohol from things here and marketing seemed like something that was achievable. And so that's what we started putting together a business plan and then brought Nick on board to help work with us on that project. And that was all in about 2011, 12, where we started putting it together.
And when you settled on a distillery, you also shared with me that, it wasn't something you could practice. It's not like brewing, homebrewed beer. It's not like making homemade wine. You can't practice distilling whiskey without the proper permits. Tell me about that process.
Most of what we do in the distilling world lives in the shadow of the chaos that Al Capone created. And so there are laws that exist today that were written when that man was still alive that have not evolved in really any way, shape, or form. And one of those is that the federal government and all the states strictly prohibit home and hobby distilling. And so it is the gap between wanting to be a distiller and actually making something that's taste-worthy and profitable is big. So when we started, we recognized that. We went to classes, we read the books, and still felt there was a pretty big gap there. And so we spent several months attempting to get a hold of and finally successfully reached out to a man named Dave Pickerell, who used to be the master distiller at Maker's Mark. And he left Maker's in like the late 2000 to, I like to say, help knuckleheads like us transition from aspirational to functional distillers. But the bourbon industry and the craft distilling is growing. And so there's a lot of knuckleheads like us. And he's very picky in terms of who he's going to work with. And so, all those things that Jamie mentioned earlier about the farm and adding value and being able to identity preserve grain from the field to the bottle were things that really piqued Dave's interest. And I think a couple times he said, this is what I was trying to get Maker's Mark to do. So he was very excited to get to work with us, who we're being authentic and transparent and really cared about the product and the way we're communicating that to our customers.
And you talked a little bit about, field to glass or seed to spirit, I think is the term you guys like to use, but you grow your own inputs for your whiskey that you sell there at Whiskey Acres. Talk to me a little bit about that process, how you decided on the varieties of corn that you use and also, some of the heirloom varieties that you're trying to work in to make your stuff completely unique.
Sure. So, of course, we're located here in DeKalb, Illinois, and we often talk about that being the birthplace of hybrid seed corn. And we have worked with and for that brand for many years as growers of seed, as resellers of that seed. Nick and I met in the seed industry. And quite honestly, I'm confident that there is no distilling organization on the face of the earth that understands corn genetics as well as we do. And again, with my background in the wine industry, I knew that grape varietals impact wine flavors, right? A Cabernet Sauvignon and a Pinot Noir grape are two different red grape varietals that make very different characteristic flavors in red wine. And knowing what we knew about corn genetics, we had a hypothesis that genetics matter. And yet the bulk of all the bourbon being made in the U.S. was basically being made at a half a dozen, eight very large industrial process type facilities that all use commodity commingled grain. And so there was no way for them to, kind of suss out flavor differences between varietals. So that was kind of our go-to-market strategy. How could we identify new varietals or existing varietals that had maybe better flavor and distilling characteristics? And so that's what we set out to do. And we worked with, quite a few varieties to settle on three or four commercially available hybrid corn varieties that we thought had some of those better characteristics. And that's where we started.
I would just add that, to Jamie, that's where we started, but the way you have to think about picking genetics for distilling is not necessarily the same way you think about picking genetics as a commercial farmer. One thing that's important is that we get the grain as dried down as possible here because we don't want to put it through the dryer and essentially pre-cook the starch. So we're starting out with, if we can, to find genetics that are lower maturity, that are going to dry more naturally. We're looking for things that often have a more defensive characteristic as opposed to just yield, because we want grain quality. We want the diseases gone. We want things that are defensive against insects. And so over these years, we've actually found things that kind of check both boxes. We don't want the farm to be planting dog hybrids that aren't keeping up with the rest, but at the same time, we need to make sure that we've got things that have a flavor profile that's unique and high quality.
The challenge that we ran into, though, and I think a lot of your farmer listeners will appreciate this, is that in the commercial variety space for corn, the life cycle of a new hybrid today is much shorter than it used to be. A new hybrid that comes out, from, a Bayer or a Corteva probably has a life cycle of about 5 to 6 years before it's being replaced by the next best thing, right? And in the distilling world, that's problematic, because once we've identified a hybrid that we like and we grow it and we distill it, we lock it up in a barrel for 5 years. And so by the time the consumer has a chance to taste it and really, we've decided we've hit on something that resonates with the consumer, oftentimes that hybrid is gone. We can't find it anymore. And so we had to kind of pivot a little bit and do two things. One, when we can, we get more access to some of the parental lineage from the majors, when they're willing to share that information, that can be helpful. The other thing that we've done is started looking more at open pollinated and heirloom corns, things that maybe have not nearly the yield potential that a modern hybrid has, but that is something that is grown or that we can grow here ourselves. and identify, you know, very interesting flavors. You know, it's a little bit like for people that garden that might like to grow heirloom tomatoes. You know, they may not have the same disease characteristics or yield potential, but they have some very interesting flavor profiles that make them worth growing. And the same holds true for some of the heirloom stuff that we grow here. The yields may be, you know, a third what our commercial varieties are, but yield doesn't matter, to Nick's point, nearly as much as some of those other flavor and distilling characteristics that we're after.
What percentage would you say of your production is that more standard, traditional, you know, the stuff you're going to have in larger quantities versus the more heirloom specialty, small batch? You know, what, how does that shake out for you percentage wise?
So it's evolving. So I used to say about 90% of what we grow is still commercial grain, you know, for fuel, ethanol, export, animal feed, et cetera. But our heirloom acres are increasing, and because they're not as productive, right, I have to grow more of them. And to be perfectly honest, the other thing that we're being very deliberate about from a farm business standpoint is, you know, we've ventured into this segment of the industry to be more profitable. That's allowing us to be more selective on some of the farms that we run in the commercial space. You know, every farmer's got to deal with land rents. We rent most of our ground, a large portion of it anyway. And some of those land rents may not be, you know, viable from an economic return standpoint. You know, they're just not profitable acres. And so we're in a fortunate position to begin to weed out some of those acres. So we're letting some farms go, to be perfectly honest with you. You know, some of those acres that don't have very good margins, you know, we're letting them go by the wayside. So as the farm gets smaller overall and our, you know, our specialty grain gets higher, that percentage is changing. And so for this coming year in 2024, it will be closer to 20%, maybe even close to 25% of our acres will be going through the distillery versus in years past. So, and that's a combination, not just of the heirloom corn and specialty corn, but also the wheat and rye acres that we're also growing for the distillery.
And, you know, I can answer that in general terms regarding the distillery. You know, Jamie answered you in terms of how the ratios of the farm and what it's growing for the distillery. But the distillery is transitioning from using a majority of the grains being commercially available yellow dent varietals to a majority of it being heirloom corns, things that Jamie has bred and grown on site here, and things that the market really doesn't have access to. You know, the beauty of what we do here is that those specialty things are grown here by us for us. You just can't go to the open market and buy, you know, a semi load of blue popcorn to make bourbon from, or if it's available, it's in a way that's so cost prohibitive that what we sell as a $65 bottle would probably be a $600 bottle. And so as the bourbon industry changes, which, you know, continues to grow in terms of consumer demand, but also grows in terms of amount of distillers that are out there, we want to make sure that we stay ahead of, you know, a glut in the market and make sure we have a diverse portfolio of offerings that are truly unique to us and of the highest quality possible.
You know, a lot of your listeners are probably familiar with the hog cycle, you know, the supply and demand, you know, a hog cycle with the peaks and valleys that occur. And, you know, knowing that, even though I don't grow hogs, you know, I'm familiar with those kinds of cycles and bubbles, and it's one of the concerns that I've had for several years about the growing bourbon industry in the United States. Is I think there's so much capacity coming online and so much supply that is still aging, right? You know, it's not like feeding a hog. It takes, you know, a lot longer life cycle. You know, a barrel of whiskey takes, you know, 5 to 6 years before it's, you know, ready to harvest. And we know, we can see the numbers that there is a lot of young bourbon in the marketplace that just isn't old enough. And when it matures and hits the market, we're somewhat concerned that there will be a bit of a supply bubble that will drive, you know, prices down. And so we're pivoting ahead of time. We see that coming. And so we're trying to do something different than the rest of the market. So by growing all this specialty stuff and being the only ones to be producing some of these bourbons, we think we can draw a bit of a moat around our supply and demand. And increasingly, we're even now breeding our own corn. So we are the exclusive distillery in some cases in the world to be growing, and we're attempting to even get patents on some of the varieties that we're making here for the distillery. So we're working on protecting that and making sure we have a value proposition for the market come hell or high water.
So we've talked about your different varieties you have that are unique to you. Do you want to share what some of those are and, you know, what makes those different from other varieties?
I mean, yeah, we can talk about it a little bit. Nick's mentioned the blue popcorn. That was probably one of the first specialties that we came out with and is probably still our most popular, I would say.
Yep.
We also have a Bloody Butcher that's on the market. That's an heirloom corn that people may have heard of from the past. There's something called Glass Gem that we've just had in the market in tests, but it's done very well. And so we've been increasing the supply aging in our warehouses. Same with a corn called Oaxacan Green. It was originated in Oaxaca, Mexico, and is a green heirloom corn that has some very interesting flavor profiles. A little bit spicy. I know that sounds a little funny with it being Mexican, but it is. It has a little bit more of a taste profile similar to a rye whiskey that we think is unique. And then we have this new heirloom hybrid that we've bred that yet doesn't have a name. We're working on naming it, but it's a cross of a corn, frankly, from the Tuscany region of Italy, along with a domestic variety that was used in the northern states during Prohibition to make whiskey. And so it has some very interesting flavor compounds and a pedigree that I think will resonate with our consumers in the bourbon space. So we're really excited about that, but it's still several years away, a couple, 3 years away from being mature enough to go to the market.
Five years for being mature enough after it's distilled. So, wasn't it 2 or 3 years to actually get the product distillable?
It's like a 7 or 8 year project, you know, to get from, you know, the original seeds and get them crossed and blow up the seed supply to the point where it's going to come into a consumer glass is quite a distance. It makes your hair thin if you could see Nick and I, because cash flow in a business like this is much more frightening than it is in even regular farming, because it takes so long for our products to come to market.
My mom's got a new Case IH tractor and it can do it all. Bale hay all day. See in the dark with its powerful LED lights. Hook up all the implements. Ship like a race car. Steer with ease. And it can also cool my juice box. Yeah, her Case IH tractor can do everything she needs it to.
Looking for a tractor that can do it all? Check out caseih.com.
So we haven't talked a whole lot about the actual process. I think people might be interested in hearing, you know, kind of a quick overview of what is the process from, you know, from when you harvest the grain, how do you actually make it into bourbon that somebody can, you know, go purchase and enjoy?
Well, you know, we'll skip the farming portion of this conversation, but step one is identity preserving the grain from the field to the farmstead here. And a handful of different ways that gets done. There's a set of four bulk bins that had a previous life holding soybeans that now hold our specialty grains. And there's a really big fleet of pro boxes that we use as well to keep things separate. Then the first step here is actually, I think, unique to most distilleries, is we take that grain and put it through a seed cleaner. And we clean it hard to get any cracked kernels out, any form, as much foreign material as possible, so that when we actually take it to the next step, we're dealing with a uniform and very clean grain sample. So step two is we mill it. We've got to expose the starches and we get that grain down a consistency of somewhere between flour and grits, and then take that into the distillery. And just kind of using very round numbers here, we take about 1,000 pounds of grain and add it to about 400 gallons of 160 degree water and bring, depending on the product, but for this case, I'll refer to bourbon. We take corn and a little bit of malted barley and bring that to a boil. And that process is just like boiling pasta, where you have to boil the pasta to soften the starch. You have to boil the corn to soften the starch in it. And once that that starch is softened, then we use a cooling system to bring the mash down to a lower temperature, where we add enzymes as it cools down. Those enzymes convert that softened starch into sugar. And when we get it down to about 90 degrees or below, depending on the product, we will add a yeast, hydrated yeast strain, and put that to our fermentation tank. One thing I want to just kind of, this is not a process, but it's something we're very proud of, in that in distilling, you use an incredible amount of cooling water. And we build a system that recirculates and recycles virtually every gallon of the water we utilize here. But in building that system, we actually significantly increased our electric usage, because we have pumps that are recirculating all this. So to compensate for that and to be as sustainable as possible, there's a solar system, solar farm here on site, that essentially offsets every kilowatt of energy we use on an annual basis. So in addition to just the lack of carbon footprint that exists by, you know, growing the grain ourselves, utilizing as little water as possible and offsetting that with solar energies probably makes us have among the most sustainable footprints of a bottle of bourbon in the world. But I'll get back to the production process here. So we've cooked the mash, we've cooled the mash, we've added yeast, and we've got it fermenting now. So the process of fermenting is literally that the yeast are consuming those sugars that we've created and converting them into heat, carbon dioxide, and alcohol through fermentation. And that takes 3 to 4 days. And after those 4 days pass, we'll have something around a 10% alcohol by volume. We call it a distiller's beer. And the difference between a distiller's beer and a regular beer is that it's still full of grain. It's still full of the yeast, and it's highly acidic.
No hops.
And no hops. And so there's booze in it, but it's not a pleasant thing to drink.
No.
But it's perfect thing to distill. So we'll pump that that distiller's beer from a fermenter into the still, and the still uses heat and vapor pressure to separate the alcohol from that mash. And the most basic sort of analogy I often like to make against that is, it's the same concept as you take a bratwurst and you boil it in beer. You know, by the time your sausage is boiled, there's no alcohol left. In the case of distilling, we're applying heat to that alcohol, we're causing it to vaporize, and giving a pathway to go through the still, where it comes in contact with the copper. It has several cycles of condensing and vaporizing, and in that process, it leaves back impure flavors and just things we don't want in our final product. Eventually makes its way through a condenser that has a cooling system in it that essentially cools the vapor back down to a liquid. And out the still comes what you can call white dog whiskey. Some folks call it moonshine. We refuse to use that word because we pay taxes on it. Moonshine is often untaxed alcohol. So once we have a clear white dog whiskey, we'll take several days of those distillations and put them in a barrel. I should say put them in a blending tank, and then they ultimately get blended together to go into a set of barrels, where those barrels go out to our rack houses, and they'll, at this stage of the game, they're probably sitting for a minimum of 5 years on anything that we're releasing. So 5 years later, we go pick out the ones that are ready, bring them back into the distillery, empty the barrels, have heart attacks every once in a while, and we find how much evaporation has happened in those barrels. The average 5% the day you fill it, because that alcohol, 5% loss the day you fill it, because it gets sucked up into the staves. And then an average of 4 to 5% annually because of the angel share that evaporates. And so we have barrels that follow those loss sort of scales. We have barrels that we open up every once in a while and find that they've either been heavily sampled or had some leaks that surprised us. Cause those are the ones that, that make us and our bankers a little bit nervous. Because what was the least one was, I think we opened a barrel, we expected 200 bottles in, and there was 21.
Yeah.
We don't like those days. So we empty the barrels. Then we have a bottling system here. We actually have bottling parties where we invite the consumers into the distillery, where we'll bottle for 2 to 3 hours. And we can fill about 600 bottles an hour. We package them into the cases and palletize them, and then send them in the marketplace.
There you go. Distilling 101.
Perfect. That was quick and easy, but not really. So you mentioned, you know, your bottling parties, and that kind of leads into another question I was going to ask you to talk about. I mean, I've been to your facility. It's a beautiful, you know, a beautiful facility there where people can come and enjoy different events. So tell me a little bit, or tell us a little bit about, you know, how the decision was made to build that there on the farm, and then invite the public out, and the different types of events and educational things that you do.
So the simple answer to that is, of course, when we can, the distillery functions much like a winery or a brewery that many of your listeners may have been to before. And obviously that's good for our business for several reasons, right? Hopefully we have an opportunity to engage with our customers and really get to know them, and they get to know our brand. And that's very important to us, right? I mean, an engaged customer tends to be a loyal customer. So that's important. Obviously, there's an economic benefit to being able to sell directly to consumers that visit here. We're able to capture more margin than having to go through a distributor or middleman and serve by the glass. So we have cocktails available for purchase, et cetera. But then the other big thing is the tours. And again, it's an engagement thing, but it's also, we've always seen it as an opportunity to teach not only about distilling, but about agriculture. And we, both Nick and I and my dad, who's also involved in the business, all feel pretty strongly about, you know, helping the general consumer understand what modern agriculture looks like, and telling that story about what farming really is. And we have a lot of visitors here from the Chicago metropolitan area, probably better than 50%. Of our customers come from there. And for many of them, it's their first time to a farm. And so to be able to talk to them, you know, really one-on-one about the things that are important to them, explain the difference between GMO and non-GMO, organic or not organic, just, you know, why we do things the way we do here, et cetera, I think is oftentimes enlightening to those consumers, and they go away feeling a little differently about what we do and what other farmers like us do in the marketplace. So that's a really great engagement opportunity. Our visitor center that we built here is substantial. It's about, you know, 4,000 square feet. We have room for, you know, about 100 people to be here on the weekends. We're open to the public on Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. All of our hours are listed on our Whiskey Acres website. And then in the nicer months of the year, you know, about 6 months of the year, we're open outside too. We have a whiskey garden that is very popular, sitting out in the shade under the trees, listening to live music and food trucks. And that was kind of a COVID response, where we had to shut our indoor facilities down. We all went outside, and that proved to be so popular that we've invested fairly heavily in making that a good customer experience. So, and then during the week, Monday through Thursday, we hold private events. So we have some that are private, you know, people rent out the facility for a meeting or a party. And some of them are, you know, ticketed events or trivia nights. I think tonight they have a bingo.
Yep.
I think we have a bingo event here tonight. So we try to make use of that facility as much as possible.
In addition to all those other things, you know, if you take a step back and look at the bourbon world, there's a lot of very good, very transparent operators out there. And at the same time, there's plenty of folks who try to pull the wool over consumers' eyes. And we think it's absolutely important, you know, from the farm side of things, to engage and showcase what we do and why we do it and tell that story, but also to be totally transparent on the distilling side of things and say, you know, here we are, here's what we're doing. And we're darn proud of that. And this visitor center is just a great platform to invite those folks in and be transparent about our operation.
Tell me a little bit about, you know, what this means to you, to your families, to the community, to agriculture. You know, what does this mean? What do you hope that the lasting impact of Whiskey Acres will be into the future?
You know, I think it's been an interesting ride for us. You know, as I think most production, you know, ag, you know, farmers aren't very close to their consumer typically, you know, right? I mean, very few commercial farms have a direct to consumer portion of their business. And so learning about that and realizing the importance of things like branding and marketing and engagement with consumers, I think has meant a lot to us. And we think maybe surprisingly has meant a lot to our community. You know, the DeKalb area is roughly 60 miles due west of Chicago. It's not known for its tourism. You know, it's a university town, it's a commuter town. It's kind of right between, you know, the ag community and the developing, growing Chicago metropolitan area. And we were surprised that when we opened up, we very rapidly became the number one tourist attraction in the area. And perhaps that says more about what tourism opportunities there are in the area, but suddenly we didn't really see tourism as being a huge component of what we do. And now it does. You know, we receive roughly 2,000 visitors on average per month through our facility. You know, I think that's meant a lot for economic development for the area. I know that the DeKalb County Chamber and the Tourism and Visitors Bureau and even the likes of some of the latest commercial development growth here, you know, we have a large new data center with Meta or Facebook. There's new Amazon warehousing. There's a big Kraft Heinz facility going in. And I know they mention Whiskey Acres when they recruit employees. You know, that's one of the things that, you know, the people that come to the area are able to do. So I think it's had a strong economic and tourism benefit to the community. The other thing that we take a lot of pride in is we try to give back. And so we do a lot of, philanthropy and charity work with organizations, partnering with them to help them raise money. I think to date we've helped a lot of those organizations over the past few years. So we feel good about that.
Yeah. I echo all the things that Jamie said. You know, for me personally, one of the big evolutions of my life is that before we opened the distillery, I didn't have kids. And, you know, now I have twins are going to turn 7 next week. And just this morning they were talking to me about, my son wants to be involved in farming and distilling. And my daughter, the crazy girl, wants to perform out here. She wants to be on stage, but is acknowledging that she's going to start somewhere. And, you know, it's a very different way of thinking of how to build something for the long term, when you have kids versus not. And, you know, I'm proud that I feel like we're putting something together that is sustainable, that if they, you know, in 15 years, they truly want to be part of something, that I think it'll be there for them to take, you know, to be part of and to grow in a way that we can be proud of.
I'd be remiss to not mention one other thing too, and that's our employees. We're blessed with a terrific group of employees that work for us. When we first started, you know, it was Nick and I and my dad, you know, and we had a couple part-time people on the farm and one full-time, I guess, individual on the farm. And that was it. You know, we were trying to do it all. And today we're getting ready for our staff party and there's 37 staffers that are coming to the party. And so I think, you know, we've grown in an employment impact. A lot of those people are part-time, so it's a way for them to augment, you know, their other income. And, you know, I know that we've had impact on helping, you know, our employees buy new cars, buy a home, you know, put their kids in private school, whatever it is that they're interested in. You know, we've been able to help them get there. And surprising to us is, I think, you know, I didn't see that as a point of pride going into all this, but I do now. I really enjoy the impact that we're having on our employees' lives. And that's a big part of what is important to me.
And I guess one last question, you know, if someone's listening to this podcast and they say, you know, I'd love to try some of that Whiskey Acres, where can they go to find more, or how do they find out if it's available near them?
So on our website, whiskeyacres.com, there's a product locator where you can type in your zip code and put that in. There are a handful of states that a third-party partner of ours can ship to, called sealbox.com, SEELBACHS.com. That's also on our website. And then if you're in your store and don't see us, ask for us by name, and then just send us a note to info@whiskeyacres.com and let us know that you're at a place that would have an interest, and we can follow up and kind of close the gap to get some more shelf space.
Currently, we're carried in roughly 700 stores, bars, restaurants, and so there's still plenty of new markets for us to enter. So we always encourage people to help pull us into their market if they can't find us. But generally speaking, you know, go to our website, find us. Yeah, you can find us in most areas around the state of
In
Illinois.
Illinois, yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you to Jamie and Nick for being our guests today. Also, thank you to our sponsor, Case IH. To learn more about Whiskey Acres, visit whiskeyacres.com. You can also check out Karen Jones's story of these hometown heroes on agriculture.com.